And now, he went on, are you ready to adventure with me into the future and see how the new world is fashioned out of the old? His words took me unawares. Prepared though I had been, I was so engrossed in the stupendous picture of a transformed world that the prospect of actually seeing some of these prophetic states made my mind reel. I will try, said Zeros, smiling at my evident confusion, to take you on a visit to your country some hundreds of years hence. You must realize that a great deal will have happened in the meantime which I am not permitted to disclose. There will be changes in land surfaces, natural boundaries will have little importance, while climatic changes will have helped to alter the way of life. You will find big differences. He talked on with the object of calming my natural excitement at the idea of witnessing events which had not yet happened in time. Gradually I came under the spell of that magnetic voice and I felt my mind becoming stilled and empty. My spiritual consciousness became more active and ceased to motivate the senses, refocusing its vision onto a higher level. I ceased to be aware of my physical surroundings and, it seemed as if I had awoken in a foreign land when I opened my eyes again, like emerging from a dream. For some time I was unable to concentrate my faculties. Where was I? Why was I here? Then the familiar shining figure of Zeros emerged from the mists of unconsciousness and I realized what had happened. The thrill of adventure rushed back into my mind and I knew that we had left the past far behind and were now conscious in a future which had not yet happened, a distracting thought. Quickly my gaze swept round over an unfamiliar landscape. We were on the banks of a river, in a town of some sort. The water glittered in the sunlight, with a strange translucence. There were noble buildings on both banks, none of which struck any chord of memory. Functionally they were quite strange to me. Clearly their design held more of aesthetic influence than subservience to utilitarian needs. There was beauty of line and concept and a fine discrimination in color. The banks of the river were lined with trees and gardens, beautifully laid out and stocked with an immense variety of flowers. There could be no smug nuisance here, I mused, as my eyes took in the cleanliness of the pastel-shaded materials used in building. My gaze swung away from the river and, I gasped. For at the far end of gently descending terraces, surrounded by gardens and lawns, stood none other than dear old St. Paul's Cathedral, a familiar friend from the past. There could be no doubt about it, for although the fabric had been cleansed from its stains, the venerable pile had an unmistakable air of antiquity. I turned in amazement to my companion. This is indeed the London of the future, said Zeros in a matter-of-fact tone, as if he might have been describing some model at an exhibition. It is a synthesis of what time will bring forth, constructed by those with vision and knowledge of all the converging trends. I looked about me for people. There were none of the hurrying throngs with which we are familiar. But there were plenty of people about, strolling in the sunshine as on a leisured Sunday afternoon. There was something different about the scene, a sort of unreality to my three-dimensional notions, but then there was indeed a difference in dimension. It was hard to accept that this busy scene had not yet happened in time. The people wore brighter colors than in our own day and their clothes were more in the nature of robes than the close-fitting garments with which we are familiar. I gathered from Zero's running commentary that sex equality had been attained and then transcended by a new and better understanding of what each could contribute to the common good. I pondered over the mighty effort that must have been exerted to bring about these immense changes in an existence which had crystallized over the centuries into a characteristic. And surely it must have been echoed throughout the world. We moved upstream and presently I found fresh evidences of the London I used to know. Westminster Abbey still stood, though its environs too had given way to open spaces. The Tower of Big Ben was still there, but much of the old Houses of Parliament had gone. Nelson still gazed out from the top of his column, guarded by his lions, but the surrounding buildings had all receded, giving place to flowering shrubs. What changes he must have witnessed through the years! Nowhere did we see any sign of dilapidation or drab rows of little houses. Planning seemed to have reached a zenith of imagination, made possible by immense changes in technique. But a part of one street was still under reconstruction, and Zeros took me to where a monster machine stood brooding over chaos. It was labeled Disintegrator. Zeros informed me that it used a form of atomic fission to disintegrate used materials into their chemical constituents, and then reassembled them into predetermined matter. To prove his point, there was a mass of pinkish powder at the rear of the machine, while at the front was a broad moor into which no doubt the debris was drawn. Leaving London, we travelled far and wide over the country. I wish I had space to relate all that we saw. The old life, with its drab patterns, had disappeared, and in its place remained a lovely land as nature made it. Everywhere we found evidences of care and attention to detail, as if these people valued their work highly. There were a few roads but no sign of railways, though in a few cases embankments could still be traced. I suppose the most important changes in the vista were to be found in the layout of the residential areas. Where the cities were less densely populated, the country areas were more in communities than in isolated buildings. Wheat was ripening, but there was little evidence of cattle or other farm animals. Presently we lighted upon a doorway set in a mound, surrounded by orchards. With an amused little smile, Zeros Mildot announced that this was the entrance to a large factory. Bewildered, I followed him down some stairs. I was accustomed to shocks by this time, but I was scarcely prepared for the amazing sight that met our entrance into an immense factory area, lofty and wide. For the whole scene was filled with humming machines, and scarcely an operator was in sight. Here, I thought, was automation at its height. Some sort of machined parts were being made, and I noted how each was machined, gauged, and passed on for further processing without any handling by human effort. Truly, man had mastered the machine at last and was no longer its slave. In no other part of this delectable land did I notice the aroma of holiness than in a hospital we visited. There was a radiance which pervaded its corridors that must surely have been a healing power by itself. The patients seemed to be those suffering from mental strain rather than physical ailments, and indeed Zeros informed me that physical illness was largely disappearing, though mental disease was more difficult to overcome. We entered a cathedral, venerable with age but not one familiar to me. But gone were the trappings of traditional worship, gone were the ancient tombs, while the altar was situated, as in olden days, in the center of the nave. It was covered with cloth of gold, and I felt somehow that from this central position teaching would be given by beings, perhaps not of this world. For one sublime moment I felt that here, at this hallowed spot, the light of the world was in contact with human souls as he had not been since those far-off days in Atlantis. It seems that, having at last come to know the composite nature of their own being and the immaterial nature of their environment, the enlightened men and women of the future had set themselves the task of becoming living examples of the new understanding. That implied a tremendous responsibility and statesmanship, for not all the world was so easily converted. First the men and women, chosen in great numbers from those nations which were ready for this spiritual conquest of the world, had to set themselves stringent tests to prove their fitness, mentally and morally. Where great armies had stood, armed with the latest in lethal weapons, new armies were recruited, armed and trained with weapons only of reconstruction, of healing, of re-education in the redemption of the natural world which the sin of man had defiled. Then they set forth to the ends of the earth on a divine mission to rescue their fellows from the chains of material thought, helping in the work of making all things new. And as they went they sang songs of praise such as this workaday world of ours has never heard, filled with the joy of constructive creation. It seemed to me that I caught some of the joyful refrains of these songs of the ethers as I opened my eyes once more in my study. Back to the old dreary but lovable city that, as yet, knew not its dramatic and wondrous destiny. Chapter 14. City of the Future. The next occasion of our travels through time and space aroused in me intense excitement, for it was to be to an era when life had assumed such novel features that it had little relation to the one we know and feel to be so enduring. My glimpse of an England to be whetted my appetite for further revelations of what the future might hold in store. On his next visit, I asked Zeros how far ahead in time this new adventure would be. He smiled a little ruefully as he replied, "Can you never learn to think outside the limitation of time? Time is such a drag upon the understanding. You must realize that the whole world will have changed in almost every respect. Not only the minds of men, but the very atoms and molecules that form matter will have changed their cohesion. Life will be quite out of focus with what you know. Naturally, your materialists would ridicule such a thought. They cannot hold the thought of such a speed up in evolution. But then they do not reckon with the infinite power of the Creator, if indeed they concede His existence. His will is not subject to human logic. In the age we are about to visit, the revolutions of the Earth will have quickened, the axis will have altered, as will the orbit of your planet. If I were to give you the numbers of years to the era we are about to visit, I should have to do immense calculations, and even then I doubt if the result would have any meaning for you. It would be like trying to get time and timelessness to coincide. Let us instead use a different yardstick and think in terms of progress and fulfillment of an age-old plan thought out by omniscience long before the world was created. Let us view the prospect from the freedom of spirit in which there is no fear, no failure, only a seemingly endless projection of wonder opening out of wonder. Could an all-powerful God of love do less for His children, so dear to Him? It all comes back to that. If you believe in God, you must submit to His will. You must not try and make Him conform to your limited outlook. A century of evolution at its present rate is not comparable to 1 hour of the goodly experience I am about to show you. It will be the same earth, but with that omitted that was never intended to be, an earth of surpassing beauty and charm, in which the demands of the lower self will be sublimated by the emergence into consciousness of spiritual power within each human soul. Try and think of your present world with all the principal causes of strife and fear and opposition removed. A world in which there can be little insecurity of life and limb that cannot readily be put right. How would such a world appeal to you? A smile flickered over the loved features of my companion as he spoke. I knew he was trying to educate my mind to these novel conceptions, to raise my consciousness so that the scenes I was about to witness should not come as too great a shock to my sensibilities. "I think it would be a wonderful experience," I replied solemnly. I knew somehow that it was going to be difficult to abandon the reliance upon an existing order of physics which had for so long excluded the need for doubt. I know you will say that man's condition will be different. But somehow I feel that something will have gone out of his life, there will be something missing. Zeros nodded in agreement. To you, yes, you are equipped with a mentality specifically designed to enable you to exist in a combative environment. But suppose you no longer regarded the product of your labor with the satisfaction born of the effort you had to make. Suppose someone came along and produced the same result with a fraction of the effort, would you still feel pride in your achievements, or would you express envy? With a laugh, I agreed that I should be consumed with envy. And I should soon be intolerant of the effort I had made to accomplish the same result, I continued. I quite see that I shall have to stand right outside of time, as we know it, in order to comprehend what is meant by the world of the future. But it is strange to think that our clumsy old world is to change from a three-dimensional life to what must be nearer the fourth dimension. Zeros confirmed this when he said, "In the age we are about to visit, man will have transcended many of the limitations that make his life so burdensome at present. Now he has to labor hard to think out his projects, assemble the labor and materials, often at great cost, and then produce with great effort. Can you lift your thoughts to an era when many of these intermediary processes can be short-circuited? Already you are beginning to do so, but imagine creation by the power of concentrated will. You know a very little about atomic fission. Matter is not so defiantly cohesive that only the application of heat or pressure can bring about a molecular change. If you are careless, you can turn your Sunday joint into carbon with ease. But supposing you could bring about such changes by simple concentration of the will upon the atoms of an object or material, and holding the thought of the change you wished to bring about. Such atoms can be controlled, and it is only the supreme conceit of your scientists that would make them ridicule such a suggestion. The artisan of the future will assemble the necessary elements, if necessary from the atmosphere, by the power of thought alone, sometimes by the concentrated power of many minds, and then fashion them into the desired shape by the same process. Do you not see that much of your machinery will thus become unnecessary? The production of all your needs will be so simple that you will have ample leisure for other pursuits, and indeed one of your future problems will be the most suitable way of employing that leisure. But first you will have to get rid of many inhibitions and fixed ideas. Again, man will not have to reason out his problems on a hit or miss method. His intuitive sense of what is right will develop so rapidly in the rarer atmosphere that he will be able to form proper conclusions without difficulty. He will have his own private oracle, as it were. And discoveries such as you have never dreamed of will await your attention, and above all, man's basic nature will have been lifted above the level where hitherto it had been his master. He will know the truth, and truth shall make him free. But remember that truth is an infinite quality, you can never plumb its depths. Therein lies its fascination. Once again I was unprepared for what met my gaze as I opened my eyes upon a scene so far into the distant future that it seemed as if time itself had been transcended. I could not help comparing the lovely land spread out before me with that of ancient Atlantis. There was the same faint unreality about the whole aspect which had characterized our first view of that wonderful land. Yet there was a livingness in all I saw that dispelled any idea of a synthetic creation. And gradually I began to detect a difference which I find it hard to describe. Could I say that this land had, as it were, grown up, while Atlantis was beautiful but immature? One felt very close to creation here and very conscious of its goodness and of its lovableness. I reached out to touch a flower resplendent with vivid color, and to my astonishment it leant caressingly towards me. For the life of me I could not have picked it. Zeros and I moved across the undulating country with our accustomed swiftness. The people we encountered were handsome, and that goes without saying, for there was a radiance about them which spoke of their innate goodness. One could hardly ascribe to them any negative qualities. Though there was sameness in the kind of clothing they wore, it was some inner quality each possessed that made differentiation easy. I gathered that these wonderful people had a very high standard of thought and deed, by contrast with our own, yet they were by no means of a common level in their moral or intellectual being. The need for education in these qualities was still essential. All this progress had been made possible by the gradual and continuous raising of the gravitational density of the Earth, which, among other results, had affected the bloodstream of humans and animals considerably, not to mention the flora and the minerals of the soil. Although I saw a number of people who were elderly in a distinguished sort of way, I did not observe any who were careworn or deficient in their faculties. Nor did I notice any cripples or sick persons, evidence of a guilty civilization. It was true, what Zeros had told me, that thought creation had almost superseded machines and manual labor. And such is the effect of human nature that when abundance was provided, demands sank to a much lower level. Everything needful for happy and peaceful existence was at hand, without the pressing need to hoard against threats or other adversity, so where was the need to conserve abundance? It is difficult for us, with our many preoccupations and need for constant labor and provision, to contemplate an existence from which it seems all the spice of life has been removed. But I recalled that Zeros had assured me that man's fighting instincts would dissipate with the need for their use, to be replaced by a more contemplative and infinitely more effective attitude of mind. We know so little of the power of thought, though we are beginning to compute its effects on our lives. No doubt the greater knowledge had to be withheld, for obviously we should have misused it. And after all, divine creation is just what I was witnessing in this advanced culture. It was the realization of their divine nature that enabled these clever people to employ the same creative principles to their needs. In this world of the future, it was clear that the need for a density of environment sufficient to hamper the expression of extreme negative impulses no longer existed, and so the environment could be lightened, as it were, to allow more freedom of spiritual power and more knowledge of its potential uses. I could not help thinking that already we are reckoning in terms of life on other planets entirely out of focus with that of our own. Our one-time conceit that we were the only form of intelligent life in the universe is slowly evaporating. In a universe that is obviously manifested out of the thought of the Creator, it is surely reasonable to say that thought creation should extend into every phase of its manifestation, wherever it is found. Thus it is that the men of the future will subject materials to an intense mental bombardment until their atomic structure comes under its influence and assumes the desired form. Zeros and I moved over great portions of this strange land, observing its many features, many unfamiliar but all in accordance with some principle of beauty. At length we perceived on the distant horizon what I can only describe as a dream city. It was not so much the elegance of the architecture which held our attention as we drew nearer, but in some queer way the appeal was to the aesthetic sense. While the city of the Golden Gates in Atlantis radiated its own beauty of form and color, it was more in the form of a divine example, a single expression of godly form, supreme throughout the land. But here I found myself possessed with the idea of fulfillment. It seemed that the ultimate in creative design had been reached. I can imagine nothing beyond this superb example of what a city might be when lifted above the purely functional. And we later found that this was but one of many. The only building which holds, for me, any comparison with the subtle distinction is the Taj Mahal at Agra in India, a mausoleum built out of the suffering of a broken heart. To stand close to its great dome and towering minarets is to realize its great size. Yet to stand a few hundred yards away and view it in the light of a full moon, is to be transported to another world. It is so perfectly proportioned that its size ceases to have any meaning. One feels that outstretched hands could take it in their grasp. Itself and beauty tugs at the heartstrings, as if the suffering that gave it birth emanated from the very marble of which it is built. I wish I could convey some idea of the entrancing beauty and sense of meaning that was inherent in this lovely city. It was there, radiating from the very materials of which it was constructed, yet I could write no more of its real meaning than I could of some exotic scent from a bottle. No harsh contrast was visible, every detail seemed to dovetail into every other. There were no walls to this open city, and it seemed to welcome visitors along its broad avenues. I noticed that there were no embellishments or ornamentation on the buildings, no hint of ostentation, no suggestion of personality. Nothing to distract from the sheer beauty of line and color and design in its most perfect form. Here and there were fountains quietly splashing crystal clear water, not to quench an imaginary thirst but to give depth to the sense of quietude and peace. In fact, tranquility seemed to be the keynote of all we saw. Trees and shrubs, plants and flowers, abounded, seeming to bloom eternally. The whole atmosphere seemed to be designed to appeal to the soul rather than to an intellectual sense, offering an appeal that could not be resisted. It was the perfect hospitality. I felt that here I could assuage all the inarticulate longings that had ever struggled for expression in my life. It was clear that there could be no inequality or inferiority in this dream city, no uptown or downtown, no privilege preserve or expression of possessiveness. It had the true communal air about it which could owe allegiance only to the highest source of all. As we wandered down the vistas, I could not call them streets, I noticed there were stalls of fruits and other commodities, unattended, from which I suppose one could help oneself. I could imagine that very little food was required to sustain life in this rarefied atmosphere, which itself held much of the forces which the body required and Indra through inhalation. Perhaps because of my constant stream of questions, Zeros led me to a large building which we found to be a vast library. Room after room was filled with books, and there were many objects forming a fair-sized museum. Most were in a language beyond my understanding, But after much search, Zeros found me a book which proved to be a child's encyclopedia, in a language somewhat resembling English. As I glanced through the pages and studied the illustrations, I became aware of a peculiar quality about the words. They seemed to attune my mind to that of the writer so that I comprehended what he was trying to convey much better than through the mere words. This textbook of the future child, elementary matter no doubt to adults of that period, was an eye-opener to me. I found it fascinating. What would be beyond the grasp of our most brilliant minds seemed to be simple to these young people. I knew nothing of their history or standards or culture, but it seemed certain that they had been born with a brain capacity far in advance of our own. I was amused to find pictures of appliances of our own day shown as examples of an outmoded existence. There were Hogarthian pictures of worthy citizens consuming vast quantities of meat, traveling in slow boxes called motor cars which collided with each other and ran people down, and in aeroplanes which sometimes fell out of the sky. Warfare was dismissed in a few horrified sentences as we might deal with slavery. Later I came upon a description of the new industrial revolution, when man overcame the machine and then found means of disposing of the machine altogether. Human senses began to respond to an infinitely wider range of tone values, in all forms of art, of music, of design. Gradually men drew closer to other coincidental worlds and established contact with them. There appeared to be a series of natural catastrophes that broke the tension which had held the material world inviolate from the spiritual worlds, and this allowed a new stream of benignant influence to enter and transform the world of matter. With the heightening of man's sensibility and the increasing vibration of the earth itself, the actual soil underwent a change so that crops increased in speed of fruition and quality of produce. New forms of comestibles appeared. In the sequence of events, I read that man began to know himself for what he is, and this knowledge engendered many changes in his habits and outlook. He ceased to eat meat and turned to the direct produce of the soil for his sustenance. And with this change his desires for great quantities of food subsided. The currents of man's whole life were to a great measure reversed. In this way man and his environment rose in condition until they became a whole stage higher than before. The elemental life which had been caring for vegetable growth came under the benign influence and was able to encourage new species and new spores from existing stocks, far better suited to man's new needs than their prototypes. Nor was this change limited to food production, for the cold intellectual outlook of humanity which derived from the crystalline nature of the mineral kingdom upon which man had lavished his interest, softened as the vibrations of the very soil quickened. From the unsympathetic rock and the brilliant hardness of the diamond he had drawn his brittle outlook, which could see only in terms of physics. His growing knowledge of metallurgy tended to smother the roundness of his inherent creative ability. Such distortions had isolated his intellect from the softening illumination of love, the power which was the theme of all creation. Thus he had lost his appreciation of divinity and squandered his spiritual heritage. But now he began to give back that hard core of his thinking to the kingdom from which he had drawn it, which involved a surrender of his self-will. Divine life began to flow in his veins once more. All this, and much, much more, became clear to me as I stood, reading this fascinating record of man's resurgence. Through the magic of the words, my mind absorbed much more than this meager reconstruction could convey. There was so much mysticism in what I learned that mere words can never reproduce it. In a sudden revelation, it came to me how very close we are to this complete change of life. And yet how far? It needs only a change of heart, an infusion of the divine essence of love into the soul of man, for a whole reversal of man's way of life, his attitude towards his fellows, and for the subjugation of his negative impulses. It requires only a working majority to experience this uplift for the whole to be transformed. It could happen overnight. We stand closer to it than we know, yet fear holds us spellbound. Even the mightiest nations feel insecure, a fatal despair holds us immobile. Many feel the position to be hopeless and drug their minds with the pursuit of pleasure. Yet it is possible to postulate the means by which this change of heart might be initiated, for the desire, the longing, is there. Never before in the known history of our world has there been such a longing for spiritual enlightenment.